Yep. Give me a nod when you're ready. Junior's ready. Stand by.
Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Bolds and Bourbon. I'm joined by my co-host Matt Gunlock, and our guest today is Joe Livy. Joe is a major in the Marine Corps, and those of us that compete on the MCMC and the championship scene know him as a really, really good competitor. I first met Joe, he was on my team for the pistol team match at Championships 2021, which is by far my favorite championships. It's the one that Matt plans. And we smoked that stage together, and we shared that medal. But ever since, Joe and I have gone back and forth. He's a really good competitor, shoots in a variety of formats, shoots USPSA, gas gun, is always out there training. In addition, you know, if you follow him on Instagram, he's a huge aficionado of, I would say, The Sopranos and also Heat. Those are the two recurring themes I see on your story. So, I guess we'll start with that. As a Paisan yourself, what appeals to you about those two bits of media?
Oh man, I could talk about Heat for days on end. I talk about The Sopranos for forever too. I think we all know that Heat probably has the best like technical direction of any film ever. Probably watching both the bank heist scene and the armored car scene as a 6-year-old set me on the path that I'm on now. Mm-hmm. So I'm still in the Marine Corps, but maybe in a few years, if there's any, you know, jobs that are baffling the LAPD, you might want to see what I'm doing.
So I will admit, I have never seen Heat except those two scenes right there.
It's a very good movie. It's well acted. It's good. It's got a good plot. But like, I would say, are you just talking about this the visceral feel of the gunfights
and yes,
just the way they're? I'm Joe. Is that what appeals to you about Heat?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's a movie about dudes and, you know, like it's a drama with like really good action in it. But I think that when you start digging into it and you look at the way they do the action scenes in the movie, it's the most realistic. And Michael Mann doesn't tell you that they're professionals. He shows you. Mm-hmm. So like, when you see them, you know, seize that armored car, like that scene looks just like any professional organization. Right, like Chris, Val Kilmer's character, who's like the young new guy, he's a breacher. He goes in, you have guys on security, you know, someone's in charge, they have comms up, like everything is done correctly. And there's never this like moment where they're like, that's Trey, he's the driver. Like, no, like, you know, he's the driver because he's driving. It's very clear that he's a good driver, right? You know, Neil's in charge because he's doing like good platoon sergeant things. I think like as a professional, that's what is appealing about that movie is that, you know, like game recognizes game, and you can see it in those scenes that like they had someone puppeting those actors who knew what was up.
Yeah, so you enjoy the fact that the movie shows you things and doesn't necessarily have to, you know, through exposition and all that, hold your hand, so to speak, which happens a lot in mainstream film. The Sopranos. So I, huge fan, obviously, but I would say that like after The Sopranos, I think what's most notable is that there really hasn't been like another mafia movie, a successful mafia movie after that. It essentially like, I mean, up until that point, Godfather, Goodfellas, you had like, it was its own genre. And then that show comes out. And since then, I don't even know if Hollywood wants to try to one up that.
No, yeah, that's actually interesting too, right? Because people say that, like The Irishman is like the counter to Goodfellas, right? It's like the less glamorous side. And I wonder if Sopranos kind of showing the less glamorous side, a little more gritty, realistic depiction, influenced that for The Irishman. So yeah, I don't think there's ever been something like that TV series, and there probably won't be because people just don't want to try to replicate it.
Right. Yeah, good stuff.
So does your upbringing and where you're from have anything to do with you being like huge fans of those movies?
So I am from Northern New Jersey. So that definitely has an impact. I definitely remember my dad always pointing out Satin Dolls Gentlemen's Club, which is, you know, the home of the original Bada Bing, as seen in The Sopranos. So most of those scenes in that TV series, you know, I'm very familiar with. And of course, you know, Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, just kind of like household names where I come from.
No, I mean, it's much the same for me with some of the movies I like and grew up on, just because I'm from Miami. So like, it's a very prevalent place where it's just used by Hollywood, just like, you know, those shows are used from where you're from. So it's like you go sit down somewhere and you're like, this place was in a movie. Shoot, like one of the schools I went to, you know, in Coral Gables was used in movies. So it's kind of cool to kind of see that, you know, those transparencies. But was that upbringing and being a part of that scene kind of what made you want to join the Marine Corps? Be, you know, you saw, you know, what's it called? What was the first Heat? You know, the action scenes, is that kind of influenced some of your decisions to join the Marine Corps?
Yeah, I don't know if Heat was part of that. I definitely saw way too many 90s and 80s action movies growing up, so that, you know, impacted me. I always wanted to serve my country. You know, I guess I was 10 or 11 when 9/11 happened, and that was, you know, right across the river from us, so that obviously had, you know, pretty significant
God,
impact.
I feel old now.
Yeah. I guess I just, you know,
Matt, no, at this point no one's about to make you feel any younger.
Yeah. So I think that was like a big driving factor. But as a kid, that's always what I wanted to do, was, you know, be in the military, go overseas. Like, that was it. You know, there's nothing else I ever really thought I wanted to do except for that. And then anything else I was interested in was like, well, I'll do that after I do this military thing.
So, like, you know, I grew up down in Miami, and you know, my biological father, he was a cop. And so he introduced me to firearms at a very young age, probably around 5 years old. We'd go out to the Everglades. But after he left us and I never saw him again, I never really grew up around guns. And it wasn't really until I came into the Marine Corps that, you know, shooting became a thing, and then competitive shooting became a huge part of my life. At what point, you know, did marksmanship and competitions really become a part of your life?
Yeah, I think it was right after I finished infantry officer's course. Two of my buddies were like, hey, we're going to go shoot this match, do you want to come? And I think for me, I was like, yeah, I definitely need to do this because I need to be good at this. Like, shocking concept, right? Like, a Marine officer should be good at shooting. It was IDPA, of course. I think we all started at IDPA.
Yes. Not me.
I did, Joe, unfortunately. Yeah,
only Matt is pure. So it was IDPA, and, you know, I was like, okay, this is kind of silly. I think even though, like, man, I don't think I need to wear a vest, but I was kind of like hooked on this like competition thing. And, you know, kind of like I alluded to before, you know, like a big thought in my head then and even now is that, you know, I need to be as advertised, right? Like, people think Marines are a certain way, like they're physically fit, they're tactically proficient, they shoot super good, right? Like all these things that people think Marines are, I'm like, man, I never want to show up and like let someone down and like make the Marine Corps look bad. So that really drove my interest, and it just kind of like took off from there.
Where was your first duty station at? Like, and were you able to continue shooting while out there?
Yeah, so I was first stationed in Camp Lejeune. I did shoot pretty much all the matches they had down at Ant Hill. So I think that they were doing like USPSA, IDPA, and like three gun was like the weird, like, if there
fifth
was like a
fifth Sunday or something.
Yeah, and like the like a half full moon, like some like weird cycle like that. And I was a member of that range too, which was a great deal. So I was pretty much down there whenever I could be, and that was kind of like my match circuit there. I think I shot like one or two ZSA matches, maybe. And I know Frank is familiar with those. but really like that local circuit was where I kind of like camped out when I was down Lejeune.
So I don't remember when I first met you necessarily, but at what point did you get into the Mi'kmaq scene?
I think the one in 21 was the first one that I shot.
Okay.
So yeah, so like when I was at Lejeune, I didn't even know that they were like going on. I had like a vague like understanding of it. And like I actually, and this is kind of funny, I didn't know you could go shoot a Mi'kmaq as an individual. I thought that
You had
your
to have
unit.
a team.
Yeah. So like the way I found out about it was like our company gunny or whatever was like, hey, like who wants to shoot this thing? And I'm like, oh, you get building a team. I was like, no, you can just go do it. It's like, oh, like, yeah, I want to go do this.
I remember 21. That was a miserable one. I
Yeah,
mean,
it was good though.
it was
Well,
good.
were you down in Lejeune or did you go
no, I was up
down
in Quantico.
CI?
Oh, was that one Quantico?
Yeah,
Yeah.
I would have noticed Joe if he was down in Lejeune because
No,
yeah.
yeah, that's right. That was Quantico because I was thinking 21 down at East, down at Lejeune.
Yes,
The Quantico one
you.
was good. The East one down at Lejeune, that was miserable for me.
It was miserable for us shooters as well.
Yes. I do have one striking memory where Joe was involved though, and this was FY22 down in, so it was, I want to say it was October of 22, and it was for, it was October 21. It was for FY22 Mi'kmaqs, and I remember we were doing the transition from rifle into pistol, and it was like a 2.5 second part time. And there was that one staff sergeant who drew too fast, was very uncomfortable, and damn near shot me in the toe. And I just looked at the guy. Was like, "Well, I'm not shot. You're not shot. Go take some water, and we're gonna recock this in about 5 minutes." And I just remember your expression, "That stupid fat motherfucker." You didn't hold back.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. That's a thing I would say. Yeah. Sounds about right.
No, that was the first time like you and I really started talking and kind of building a relationship. And I mean, it was because I've heard your name and everybody kind of talked about you, and finally, like, I really got to work with you some and have some interaction, because half the time I was stuck in a fucking office and it was just miserable. And so that year I got to be out there teaching, instructing, and doing Marine things. So you do participate in a lot of disciplines. You do gas gun, but USPSA mainly, but also float between different platforms. What's drawing you to the different specific disciplines that you do shoot?
Yeah, so I try and think about being like a well-rounded shooter. I know I think of one person who I won't name, but he can like shoot a pistol super great, but his rifle work is abysmal, right? Like I don't want to be that guy. I want to be able to perform kind of like across the spectrum well. I think USPSA is very accessible, which is kind of why I jump into it with 2 feet. And I think that most of the skills in USPSA apply to other disciplines as well. So I can't really say enough good things about USPSA. I really like gas gun. I think that's like a pretty solid test and it's very realistic. It's also very accessible. It's like a newer shooter. So huge fan of gas gun. The Quantum Performance series I think is really good. And then as far as like what pistol or rifle I'm shooting, I do like to just try out some stuff for a little bit and just see what it's like. So I'm doing like single stack summer right now because I want to shoot something different. I want to shoot, with the 8-round magazine, iron sights, like kind of go all the way back to basics, get some experience doing that, as opposed to just riding through one division all the time. I think it also kind of keeps it interesting for me. Kind of like helps me, retain a little bit of interest and keep things new.
Yeah, you're inspired. I have a Dan Wesson in 9mm that I'm probably gonna end up shooting once Open Nationals is done. I just need to get like mag pouches and all that stuff. But I started off in low cap in production, and I think it'd be cool to go back to it. I might learn a thing or two after having been spoiled by an open gun. What are your thoughts? So over at Quantico Shooting Club, we started to split our matches between USPSA and PCSL. Thoughts on PCSL? We've done two so far at Quantico, and it seems to be very popular.
Yeah, I love PCSL. I think, the rule set makes a ton of sense. I think the divisions make a ton of sense. They're very easy to understand. I remember a few years ago, like an idiot, I show up with my carry gun, which has a compensator on it. I'm like, carry optics. And they're like, no, you're not in carry optics, you're an open. But, for a layman is like, I carry this gun with an optic, therefore
Right.
carry optics. It's like, no, it's not. Whereas PCSL, it's a clear line, like competition practical. Like, you have a competition gun, you know you have a practical gun. It's very simple. So I like that. I like those divisions. Max Liagranis is like, you can wear a leg strap or not. Like, no one cares because it doesn't matter. It makes no difference.
Right.
So kind of cut through all that stuff, which is great. I really like the target tree. I think that most of the USPSA target, right? Like, we've all torn down stages. 50% of target isn't shot. So like, why even have it there? So someone has like a no penalty mic in the form of a Delta. And I think really what I find most interesting about PCSL is the K zone, because it can completely transform how you shoot a stage. You can look at a stage and say you're shooting practical, so you got 21 plus one round as your starting capacity, and it's a 24 round stage. Well, now I can look at this stage and start picking up K zones and avoid a reload. Or I can determine that, hey, the time needed to do a K zone isn't worth it, and I'll just burn a reload between positions. So it adds a level of planning. It adds just a different layer that I like. Frankly, I think for like the tactical Timmy, right? Like, it does make it a little bit more reasonable. Like, yeah, if I put one in the K zone or the upper A zone in a USPSA, like I think I'm good. I don't need to put two there, right?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think really, hit factor rifle has always been popular. I think, you can shoot a rifle in USPSA, but it has to be a PCC. And really, what people want is the ability to run their 223, 556, their AR essentially in a USPSA format. So, yeah, I mean, I intend to keep PCSL around. There's plenty of good USPSA matches in the area. Like, we have an embarrassment of riches in this area. So yeah, might as well stick with the PCSL. So have you become very picky about the matches that you end up attending? Like, what's your criteria?
Yeah, I think we're definitely spoiled up here. There's more good matches than bad matches. If it's USPSA or PCSL or Qualified Performance, it's pretty much like it's guaranteed to be a pretty good match. If I have the choice between like a gas gun or a two gun or USPSA, I'll just default to the gas gun or two gun because they're more rare like in the area. And then, a closer match, like, hey, if it's on Quantico, it's very easy for me to get over there. But I'm also looking at, the size, both in like stages, right? There's six stages versus four. It's pretty easy for me to justify. And then, to be frank, like, hey, if all my friends are shooting the whatever match, like, yeah, I'll go shoot with my friends as well, right? Like, I think we forget that we're there to have fun and hang out with our buddies sometimes too,
So
Yeah.
honestly, and everything you just said, what I heard is, Frank, we want to have more PCSL two gun, three gun matches. So let's bring those on.
Is the half and half split not enough?
No, I'd like once a month.
I know,
So
but
I don't have to travel 4.5 hours,
I get it. Yeah, honestly, if we had more volunteers, like we could do more than one a month. But with me and Alex just there, I don't know. It's definitely a conversation. But I'm also hesitant to do away with USPSA entirely, because Tim Hitchcock built a huge
Oh,
USPSA presence there.
absolutely.
So yeah,
There's something else I could get thrown away, though, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's interesting though, like the PCSL versus USPSA, because you can do PCSL one gun, right? And I think for the competitor, for the guy that is into shooting like as a serious endeavor, the only thing PCSL doesn't have right now is classification.
Yeah.
Yeah, based on what I talked about, based on my conversation with Tim, though, like people care about their classifications. They
Oh,
care.
absolutely.
Like one of the things that he was like dead set on, he was like, you have to upload these scores by Sunday night so that they hit USPS and you got to pay whatever bill that they got for number of shooters for classifiers or whatever, your little match fee, so that it hits the classification system by Wednesday. And he was like, that was one of his, there's a lot of absolutes with Tim Hatchek, and that was one of them.
So I have a question because I don't know. Does Quantico Shooting Club still do Steel Challenge?
They do.
Okay, let's
And
get rid of that.
well, that's it's actually, I think it's one of the most profitable matches
Well,
because
it's a
yeah,
gateway sport.
it is. I get it. But so I think with Steel Challenge, you are more likely to get your, I guess, your high power crowd, like the really young kids and also the super old people, like, 'cause it's static. It is the same every goddamn time. And that appeals to some people. The same reason that high power appeals to them. It's the same course of fire.
Joe's thinking. I want to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, go for it, Joe.
No, it's really funny because I did shoot those Steel Challenge matches down at Ant Hill, and I completely forgot Steel Challenge even existed. Like, it's just so far off my radar. Like, I won't even consider it because, I know I'm sounding like elitist right now, but
Well, we are.
it's gonna be the same thing every time, which does not appeal to me, right? Like, I want to go to a good match with interesting stage design, like an interesting problem to solve, as opposed to just, memorizing like a kata, right? And then for me, like, I can accomplish the same thing in like my own practice and not wait for other people,
Well, it's a
right?
drill. It's all
Right,
it is.
it's
You're shooting the
drills.
same drill, what, 4 or 5 times and see what your fastest score and it averages out. Like, I don't care about that. Like, I want something more interesting. Frank, I'm not saying we should get rid of Steel Challenge because yes, it is a profitable match for QSC, but I'm also saying let's get rid of it so we can bring on more interesting matches that are going to force people to shoot a diverse set of
Yeah.
targets, and they're not going to be able to game it like and just stand still and shoot a drill. Like, let's think real life. A gunfight is not going to be a standstill sport.
I agree. It's also it's a gross underutilization of those sat bays. Like, you don't need to have those in bays. But I think what appeals to people about Steel Challenge is the idea that, they look at USPSA and they don't have to reset a stage. All they have to do is go up with a little spray can. Literally, one person can do it. They can sit underneath the awning for the entire time. If they want to shoot multiple guns, they can. It's actually super encouraged. And I think Steel Challenge also activates the part of your lizard brain that, like, the same reason that people like slot machines, because that's kind of what it is.
Well, I have an idea. You can utilize range 1 or range 2 for Steel Challenge because it is wide enough to just have everything, dispersed between those ranges, width-wise,
Yeah.
and you can accomplish the same thing rather than just utilizing the bays, and they can utilize the bays for 2-gun, 3-gun.
Yeah. Joe, did you have something to add?
No, it is also like an interesting thing to like ponder, right? Because we talk about it and we're like, this is for like a newer shooter, right? Or someone who's like not comfortable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if we started everyone out with like, here's a pistol. This is how you like draw to your holster, and like you can go walk over there, and like be aware of your muzzle, right? So like building that in people from the beginning, you probably have like better, safer, more competent shooters, right? It's the same thing in the Marine Corps, right? You start out on table 1, so if you have a malfunction, raise your hand. Well, if we started out with saying like, hey, this is your rifle, it's your responsibility, right? Solve your own problems, we probably have more competent, better thinking shooters from the beginning. So I get that people like Steel Challenge, and that's totally fine, right? I'm not like being a hater. I just wouldn't want to see someone like use it to like crutch somebody up. Like, I don't think people need that as a crutch if they're starting. If you like it, that's fine. But if someone was like a brand new shooter, I wouldn't feel like I had to introduce them to that before I put them in a USPSA match.
No, I've introduced so many shooters into USPSA just straight up. Never even occurred to me that we should maybe pump the brakes a little bit and start with Steel Challenge. Probably because, like you, Steel Challenge occupies zero headspace during my waking moments. But that's enough. That's enough bagging on. Man, someone's gonna like vandalize my. Somebody's gonna like vandalize my car with a steel paint or something after they listen to this.
It'd probably be directed more toward me.
Yeah, I mean, we all bagged on it a fair amount. But Joe, you train a lot. See you out at the range, you know, putting up your shot groups, to see a lot of matches. What does a typical week look like in terms of your dry and live fire practice? How do you block that out with a full-time job and all the other stuff you got going on?
Yeah, so I will dry fire pretty much every day. I will do like a 15-minute block of like focused dry fire by itself. So I'm either working on, you know, gun handling stuff, right? Draws, reloads, it's almost kind of like manipulations. I do a lot of work with like vision, right? So like transitioning from target to target, you know, seeing things as I want to see them, right? Being like target focused, not front sight focused when I want to be, stuff like that. And I think that, you know, doing that every day, I'm not doing live fire, really knocks out most of like the practice that I need to get in, so that when I do go do live fire on a Saturday, like all that stuff is done. I can just do, you know, confirmation of the skills I've been training the rest of the week. Another thing that I think, you know, helps me a lot with just getting everything done is that I will usually work out at home, and I will always dry fire in between sets. Like I'll always have like a gun out with my workout equipment, and, you know, I'll do whatever I'm doing, and like my rest is I'm dry firing on pasties or something on the wall. I'm just getting that gun in my hand. I think that that's a big thing people don't place enough emphasis on, that, you know, the more time you have with that pistol or that rifle in your hands, the better you're going to be. It doesn't need to be like out of the Ben Steger book, right? Like I got all the books back here on the shelf, right? But you don't need to follow the program. You're going to be better if you do. But so long as you're getting time on the guns, I think that's like really what makes the difference between like being at like 80% and like 85 or 90%, right? I'm lucky, again, we got so many matches in the area that I can pretty much, I can live fire, practice, and compete, you know, every week. And it's easy like that. You know, I don't really have to make a decision, I guess, between choosing train or go compete usually.
I have a question in terms of, like, I have dry fire targets, but sometimes I do it with stickies. And there's certain reasons why I'll do stickies over dry fire targets. But do you use dry fire targets, or do you predominantly use stickies on the wall, pasties?
Yeah, I've always just used the pasties. And, like, I understand people, the argument is that, again, you want to see what you're going to see in a match. I like just throwing up like a pasty or like a reduced size square or something on the wall, because in a lot of matches, like the Gaskin matches, it's going to be just some geometric shape at a different distance. And it's less about, you know, what shape target I'm looking at than how I'm placing my vision on a particular point and how I'm placing, you know, the dot or the irons on it. So for me, I like the flexibility and, you know, frankly, the low cost of just throwing up stuff, you know, like on deployment. I had post-it notes all over a certain BTC room that was my like dry fire room. You know, people would be like, what's these pasties for? Like, oh, don't worry about the post-it notes, just leave them there. Like, they don't mean anything. Right. I couldn't have done that with, you know, USPSA cutouts on the wall. Someone would have noticed what was going on in that room after hours.
Did you have like a dry fire pistol, or what did you use? A service pistol?
Yeah. So we, you know, I had a really good like command climate, like super supportive of that. And like me and a few other guys, we had like on the, you know, team's calendar, that little calendar, we go dry fire like 3 days a week. You know, part-time timer, all that, you know, clear the guns out again, follow the safety rules, make sure everything's safe. Never had an accident, but yeah, just service pistol, service rifle.
You already mentioned the Ben Steger books. Is there anything else you consume in terms of media, training media? I see you pretty active, like commenting on like Mike Pannone's page and some others. But yeah, where do you, are there any podcasts or are there any other websites or any other material that you typically look at?
Yeah, so I will pretty much listen to all the PSTG podcast stuff. Anything, you know, from Steger, Pranka, Pannone, kind of like those circle, like I will listen to, because I think there's a lot of good stuff in there. You know, and it's funny, people say, you know, Ben Steger or Matt Pranka or Mike Pannone, they're mean or they're grumpy or they're toxic, but no one says they're wrong. Interesting, right? No one's saying that Ben Steger doesn't know how to shoot. They're just saying he's mean. Like, that's fine, man. Like, I want to get better at shooting, right? I'm not trying to take him out on a date. So yeah, I'll consume all that stuff. And then, you know, I'm trying to always kind of see what better shooters than me are saying about the matches they shot. So I'll, you know, follow those guys. And sometimes, you know, there's like a nugget, there's like a gem in there, you know, and sometimes there's something that, you know, I disagree with and I'll think about it. And, you know, who knows, maybe a week later or a year later, I'm like, oh, I think I was right. You know, I was wrong. And now I see why he felt that way. So that's kind of where I sit as far as consuming, you know, shooting content.
Hey, on that, I just have a quick question because I've been talking to Pannone. I talked to him Saturday evening and I talked to him today. But if I organized a class where he flew out here and did some classes, would that be something you're interested in attending?
Yeah, 100%. Which, you know, I think that's a testament, right, to like the quality that guy puts out. You know, like, you asked me this question off the cuff. Yes, I would pay money for that. Done. Right. Solved. No hesitation.
All right, I'm gonna keep trying to organize this. I want to put it like out a call to action to see who's interested. And for any of you listeners who are in the Virginia area who are interested in potentially coming out to a Pannone class, just hit us up on our Bulletin Bourbon's Instagram page, and we'll kind of use it as a gauge on interest. And yeah,
we could also throw up like one of those polls on our story as well. So yeah. Look out for that kind of stuff. So we've talked a lot about training, and we talked a lot about, you know, working specifics. What are some things that you're working on right now? It can be pistol, it can be rifle, big picture. Like, actually, if you want to tell me one thing that's just like a recurring thing that you're always working on, and then what's the flavor of the week?
Okay. So a recurring thing, I think, is just, I'm always trying to like find like a steady state. I'll call it 90%, or I think 80% is too low, like a 90% at like everything, right? So I think that's kind of why, you know, you see me, I'll shoot a gas gun match one day and I'll shoot USPSA like the next day, because I don't want to ever let one of those atrophy. So I'm shooting Area 8 on Saturday and I'm shooting Quantico Performance the next day on Quantico. Right? I think that's like a good example where I'm trying to always maintain those skills. Right now, and the big focus for me is pistol. So I am shooting Area 8. So that's, what is that, like the end of August, the 27th or something, 26th, yeah. I think.
Last week in August.
Yeah, so it's kind of like my like train up to that. After this week, you know, I'll be done shooting single stack 1911, because I'm done, right? That's just like the time period that I set aside to do that. So come this upcoming Saturday, I'll be back shooting limited optics. So I'm going to shoot a bunch of USPSA matches with that. I'm going up to Thurmont because I know they put on a good, you know, six stage match. So we're shooting that on Sunday, right? Which means I get to train on Saturday. And then I guess it's the second week of August. Pranka and DeFore and Blowers are doing like a big course down at the former Blackwater facility. Mm. So I'm like, hey, I want to get in on that, right? I want to hear what Pranka has to say from the horse's mouth. So that'll kind of be like the week or two before Area 8. So Yeah, end of July into all of August, basically, like all pistol all the time. So I will sweat to death probably. But I'm gonna definitely still try and like maintain that rifle stuff, you know, that rifle ability. And I think probably I'll probably say like September, I'll kind of tip the scales a little bit and lean more into rifle, a little bit less pistol, and focus a little bit more on some of that like 100 and in carbine work. I've been, you know, pretty focused on the gas gun side, and I just noticed shooting the recent PCSL 2-gun, 3-gun that, you know, like my splits and target transition splits between targets for the carbine wasn't quite where I wanted it to be. So that's kind of going to be the next thing that I'm focusing on. So, you know, it's a never ending thing, right? Like once you get good at one thing, you're bad at the other, and you just go back and forth, and it's that way until you die, I guess.
Do you ever like your ability to go from one big match to another big match, or do you ever see skill sets atrophy within that day? Like, you know, you're on one day and then the next day you might be exhausted. Do you ever see any skill sets atrophy there?
Yeah, I mean, in the moment, like at the match, I don't ever want to admit it because I think that when you admit it, you know, you start giving yourself excuses, right? It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, like, oh, I'm tired, I'm dehydrated. Whereas if I just tell myself I'm not dehydrated, then I'll perform better. Maybe that's true or not. It sounds very Marine Corps, though. I think, you know, any professional athlete, right? Like you train up to an event, you peak, and then you start coming back down, right? And you know what, like me and you know Frank and I were talking about, you know, how he went from Duskin to the Maryland match, right? Like we're always trying to be at the top of our game. So I think like yeah, you know, I'll see a little bit of a dip, but if you're fit, if you recover smart, you know, you're drinking water and not, you know, beer, you probably are going to be like 95% one day and like 93 or 90% the next day. You're not going to all of a sudden, you know, be unable to hit a target at 25 yards. Like you're going to be a little bit slower. Your stage playing might not be super good, but other than that, I think it isn't too bad that degradation going from two big matches like that.
So you and I, we got to talk a lot during championships, and I'd say that we, you know, we sh a lot of the ways that we see the Marine Corps is similar. Usually, officers are expected to be diplomatic and political, and you and I, sometimes we ruffle some feathers because of how honest and blunt we are. So was that always a part of officership for you? So for me, I was completely different coming in as a lieutenant, or when I was a lance corporal. I just After a certain amount of time, I was just like, if you care about people, you'll be honest with them. You know, that was kind of the realization I had. Because from my perspective, going from enlisted to officer, it just seemed like the officer ranks were more concerned with just being buddies with each other. At some points, it felt more like a fraternity than an actual military organization. So just curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that I've always been outspoken. I think the word's big mouth in some circles, but I remember you know, we used to get like our peer evals done, right? And you would pick from a drop-down menu of positive and negative comments, and I would often get a few candids and a few blunts, which is just the same side of the same thing, right? I think from like the followership side, right? Like if I'm someone subordinate, I feel like I owe the truth to them, right? Like they deserve honesty from me. Otherwise, right? Like I'm lying to my boss, and that's just it's not right. You should never lie to your boss and tell them that everything's okay when it's not. And from like the leader side, you know, you should want to hear the news even if it's bad news. Otherwise, you're just getting lied to. Like this whole thing that I think you know, you've seen, everyone's seen at some point in the Marine Corps where the boss never wants to hear anything bad. So therefore,
Oh,
no one tells
yeah.
anything bad. You know, we hear these stories about how things were in like the Soviet Union or like under like Saddam Hussein's Iraq. It's like, oh, that's like ridiculous. That would never happen. It's like, dude, you're in it right now. Like you're doing that thing where you just don't tell anyone anything bad because you know he's going to have a negative reaction. Like, granted, the boss isn't going to, you know, take you outside and decapitate you, but you understand that just never saying anything is not that good. It's just better for you in this weird social construct. And I think that, you know, as Marine officers, like, we should be focused on like the mission and the men, and anything other than that is kind of irrelevant. So we should be very, very honest in trying to drive the organization to succeed and be better. And we shouldn't be overly sensitive at telling people like, hey man, like if you started this thing on time, it would be better. Like that shouldn't upset someone. Like they should have that already in their mind that they're doing, you know, very ruthless after action reviews of their own actions. So you telling them ways to get better should not upset them.
Well, I think you could definitely tell the quality of leader, not just officer, but leader in general, by their ability to take that information, take your bluntness, and act off of it. You know, and it even comes down to telling the truth. If you screwed up and they ask you, did you screw this up? There's no reason and why you shouldn't tell them the truth, because, you know, they're going to find out at some point, and then the severity is going to be a lot worse. That punishment is going to be a lot worse. So by you not being open, blunt, honest with anybody, you're doing nothing to help that organization. And some people will cave under what you tell them, and some people will rise to the occasion. And I mean, I think we all know somebody who was not good at receiving blunt information, and he caved and he ended up failing and getting fired.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny too, because I'm sure we've all heard this, right? It's like, don't bring me a problem without a solution. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's the most terrible thing to tell someone, right? Because that Lance Corporal, he definitely doesn't have the experience needed to solve all the problems, but I want to hear his feedback. Mm-hmm. Like, I want Lance Corporal, you know, whoever, to be like, hey, sir, you know, I've noticed that there's a backup at this station. Like, I don't know what to do about it, but this is a problem, right? Everyone's getting, you know, bottlenecked here. Like, oh, thank you. Like, great idea. Like, we'll do A instead of B now. Like, thank you for bringing this problem to my awareness. You know, like, when I call 911 and my house is on fire and they pick up the phone and I'm like, hey, my house is on fire. Like, well, tough luck, man. What kind of truck do you want? Like, mm-hmm. No, like they come with a fire truck and like they bring the right truck to solve the problem. Like, that's what the expert's for. You know, and a leader should be taking on that positive criticism, you know, bringing up issues in order to solve the issues of the organization and make everyone better, rather than demanding a less experienced junior subordinate also bring the solution to the problem.
I mean, now, if you do have a solution, do give the advice. Like, if you have it, you know, because it might actually work. But you shouldn't, like you said, you shouldn't necessarily demand anything from them.
Yeah, agreed. Like, I want to hear everyone's feedback. I want to hear everyone's solution. You know, I think probably the best solutions come from like the bottom. Those are like the simplest solutions too, the most effective. But kind of like demanding that you bring a solution with the problem that you're seeing is a way of like silencing people from raising issues.
Yeah, for sure. I usually have a solution ready. Because one, it's an officership thing, but I'm also a commo and no one understands comm. So if no one else is going to figure it out, then it's got to be the Asian guy, right? How has that changed throughout the ranks? So like that approach or that philosophy, because the Marine Corps as a lieutenant is vastly different as a captain and now as a major.
Yeah, I think it was almost easier as lieutenant, because you had other lieutenants to kind of bounce ideas off of that were like very adjacent to you. And that like lieutenant to captain conversation is very different than a major to colonel conversation for, you know, whatever reason. I still think though that, you know, regardless of what rank you're at, if you've built rapport and people understand that you're competent, you have more leeway in what you can say. You know, I think, you know, that's kind of like the unspoken thing here, right? Like if you're a terrible Marine, like, you know, no one cares what you have to say. But you know, if you show up, you're super competent, like you're a real professional, and you make an issue, people will take that with more weight, as they should. So I don't know if it changes, you know, as you go on. I think maybe the flavor is a little bit different. How you gotta get advice along the way changes.
Well, I mean, both you and I just promoted a major. I think it gets more difficult to get honest feedback the higher up you go, and just the way numbers work, your peer group is smaller too, so it becomes more important for you to be honest and get to the point with your peers. There's just less of you, and you got to rely on each other. So I've yet to actually experience that, but I already saw it going from lieutenant to captain. But we appreciate your time. I thought this was a really good conversation. But at this point, is there anything that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
You know, I think it's just important, you know, for the Marines out there who listen to this, like, you got to be confident with your weapons. You got to be physically fit. You got to be tactically proficient. You got to be mentally tough. Like, those things are not negotiable. And it's kind of on you to do those things. I feel comfortable saying that because I'm trying to set the example here. And you know, I think we can all agree I'm at least trying, if nothing else. And I think that, you know, this is one of those things that you've never arrived. You've never like reached the top. So you got to fall in love with the process. And I think that if you can fall in love with the process, you can probably be, you know, very, very good in this endeavor.
Very well said. If you shoot locally to the Quantico area and you show up at a match and you see a dude wearing a tank top, an American flag tank top, and rocking a 1911, it's probably Joe Livy. And he's probably going to stomp you, but that's okay because that's also part of the process. We appreciate the conversation, man. This was really fun. And for our listeners, let us know how we're doing. Thanks.
Hey, you know what? Before we sign off, you forgot the tiger stripe cami bottoms.
Like, that's right. That's
those right. are glorious. And for the listeners, so they know where to get them, where did you get those?
So those are from Tactical Distributors. They're down in Virginia Beach. They don't have a walk-in store, but if you're up in Quantico, it's basically next day shipping because of how efficient UPS is. So that is a win for capitalism right there.
Hell yeah. Well, I hope you take that bit of information, listeners, and get yourself some Tiger Stripe cami bottoms, because I know I probably will.